Hi, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. This Thursday's episode is a little different, as it is the recording from our second Next Steps event, which we hosted in the amazing surroundings of the House of Lords in College Green. On the night, we were joined by a panel of three great guests: Brendan Mooney, former CEO of Kainos; Andre Reynolds, CEO of Swoop; and Terry Clune, CEO and founder of Clune Tech Group. We got so many great insights from the panel. I hope you enjoy, and remember to like, share and subscribe and comment if you do. So sit back and take a listen. For tonight, we are going to really, I suppose the goal tonight really is to give some sort of insights for company owners, which most of you are in this room, really around the possible routes to either selling your business, taking on external capital, or and trying to scale your business, or ultimately IPO it. And it will be a kind of a panel discussion with myself and my three guests here, one from each camp. That's why they're here. I'm really interested, I suppose, in the financials of any deals or companies or things like that. It's much more about trying to look at the various routes and opportunities that are open to people and business owners in terms of passing on or developing their business, and trying to get some insights into the journey and maybe the process overall that we've got. Two bits of logistics. One, if anybody needs the toilets, they're out the back door and around to the right. But more importantly, if anybody has any questions, you will see, I think on that screen, there is a QR code. You can scan the QR code. It'll automatically give you an email address. If it doesn't, the email address is davynextstep@gmail.com. If you want to write your questions in there, they'll appear up on this little device that I have here. And as we go through it, any questions that come in, I'll certainly work in. Or alternatively, at the end of the formal part, we're going to have a Q&A session with some roving mics that we'll have out. So we'll get all of your questions answered as we go through. So the really important thing, as I said, I'm just the moderator to ask all the questions here. The guests are the really important ones. And moving from my left across, my first guest is Terry Clune. As a result of difficulties trying to claim back German tax he had overpaid working in the summer, Terry decided to take matters into his own hands and started preparing German tax returns for his university friends. This resulted in the establishment of TaxBack.com in 1996. Driven by Terry's keen eye on business and entrepreneurial spirit, TaxBack.com has since become one of just a collection of global companies that make up Clune Tech Group. Clune Tech is now the parent company of Ireland's most successful and groundbreaking fintech brands, including the likes of TransferMate Global Payments, Amidus, and TaxBack International. In an ultra-competitive fintech sector, Clune Tech companies are at the very cutting edge of financial innovation, developed here in Ireland and exported to the world's largest multinational clientele. Next to Terry, we have Andrea. Andrea Reynolds, with more than 20 years' experience in corporate finance, largely focused in matching business with funding and investment opportunities. Andrea launched Swoop in 2018 to help SME startups scale up and finance their new ventures. Swoop has developed a new technology platform designed to simplify and speed up access to loans, grants, and equity funding for SMEs. It effectively works as a sort of virtual CFO, pulling in a business bank's accounts and other data to help it ascertain better financing options from a wide range of lenders, investors, and government grant agencies. It also helped business unlock cash by establishing ways to cut costs for banking, utilities, and other services. While Britain is the company's main market, it does have a growing customer base in Ireland and is now firmly focused on North America. And finally, on the far left, we have Brendan Mooney. Brendan joined Kainos in 1989 as a trainee software engineer before moving into a number of technical and commercial roles. He was appointed to the top job in 2001 and floated the business on the London Stock Exchange in 2015. At the time, the firm was valued at 161 million, compared to well over 1.4 billion today. Kainos provides digital technology services and platforms for public and private organizations in the United Kingdom, Republic of Ireland, and internationally. It operates in two divisions, digital sector and healthcare organizations, as well as providing consulting, project management, integration, and post-deployment services for Workday software. software suites. He announced his decision to step down as CEO from the company in 2023. Folks, you're very welcome, and thank you so much for agreeing to be here tonight, and I hope I got all of the CVs right. We'll just nod if it didn't. Clary and Andrea, I'm going to start with you, because I'm always very interested in this one, as your founders of companies. When did you consider yourselves entrepreneurs or business people?
Never. Swoop started from, I had a corporate finance firm, and I was helping businesses, spin-outs from Formula One, McLaren Formula One, to raise money for very capital-intensive businesses. And so I was literally looking under every rock to find money, and it was grants and R&D tax credits. And I couldn't believe how hard it was to figure out the grant landscape in the UK. I used to be an auditor, and I essentially audited the grants landscape of the UK, realised how much money the government was wasting on it, got to present my findings to the Minister for Business in Downing Street, and they were like, you're absolutely right, the whole thing's a mess, but who's going to fix it? And I was like, fine, I'll go fix it. And, at the time, cloud accounting was emerging, we had open banking, and I just essentially worked out everything I'm doing that's admin-heavy, friction, high friction, I could be doing through data, and I could be matching businesses to grants, to loans, all through their data. So everything I'm doing manually, I could automate. And so it was from frustration, it was from pain, it was, well, who else is going to do it? I think the moment where I was like, oh God, this is getting serious, is when I hired my first employee. And then suddenly you realize you're responsible for someone's mortgage, for someone's family. I think it's a slow realization as opposed to, I'm just going to go fix this. That's how it was for me. I'm not sure about Terry.
Thanks, and glad to be here. Yeah. Thanks, Aidan. I'm from a farm in Wicklow, and I started a little business when I was eight, collecting fertilizer bags from neighboring farmers who would usually burn them on the side of the fields. I used to gather them up into bags of 20 and sell them to wood merchants for a pound for a bag of 20. They would use them for timber, selling timber in petrol stations. And Saturday afternoons for me wasn't GA or football. It was cycling around on my BMX bike to my farmers, giving them a few Snickers bars and collecting the bags. And but when did I learn that I was an entrepreneur? I suppose the challenge of an entrepreneur is keeping your business alive. I suppose, sadly, when I was eight, my business went bust. Because this younger lad, this seven-year-old, came across the Wicklow Hill where I saw what I was doing, and he was a lot smarter than I was. He saw what I was doing and ultimately came up with a better bag, a see-through bag that customers much preferred, that they could see how much wood was in the bags. And ultimately, he saw what I was doing, came up with a better product, and put me out of business. Best lesson I ever learned, The second you start sitting around eating Snickers bars, getting fat and lazy, you got to watch your back and keep innovating. Yeah. But that's when I got started.
Do you think, and all three of you can answer this one, do you think entrepreneurship is an art, a science, or a philosophy?
I think it's a mindset.
Yeah.
I think it's a mindset. I think it's just you see something, you know you can do it better, you're full of optimism about doing it better, full of confidence you can do it better. I wouldn't call it arrogance. I think it's just an absolute determination to build something better. So I think it's a mindset. I don't know what you both think.
I think it's a lot of hard work. Actually, I mean, I think that I agree with Andrea that you can see something, you can think you can do it better, or it's worth trying to do it better. Mm. But, having the ideas is an important part of the process, but it's what comes after, the execution. So to me, it's about that constant execution, iteration, improvement. So I would say it's hard work alongside that inspiration.
Mm-hmm. And Brendan, you're interesting because you've had a very long career in Kainos. You were the CIO or the CEO at the IPO, but you weren't the founder of the company.
No.
Did that make a difference, do you think?
Did it make a difference? No, I mean, the founding CEO is a guy called Frank Graham. And, Frank started Kainos in 1986, but he also, I guess, doesn't fit that natural definition of entrepreneur, because the funders, the founders of the business were Fujitsu and Queen's, who put together that £50,000 to create a business. And their, I think the real stroke of genius was hiring Frank, because Frank brought that drive, that desire to grow a business in Northern Ireland, which at that time, which is in 1987, it started trading. I graduated a couple of years later, but I was one of a class of 28 in computer science. And of the 28, 24 had to leave Northern Ireland to get jobs. So his focus, among lots of things, was about how do you provide great employment for local people so they don't have to jump on a plane or a train or a boat to go and find employment elsewhere. So did it make a difference for me? I guess yes, in that I still think the company today feels very much like the one I joined 35 years ago. I think those same principles about, getting the very best people possible into your business, focusing on your customers and the service you provide to them, and then think about your financial performance, because as a largely services business, you should be profitable quickly, and you should manage that very strongly. That allows you to be invest in the future. So in that regard, it was easier, I think, for me, because I just had to take what Frank had done for 14 years and make sure I didn't mess it up.
Mm-hmm. The one thing, I suppose, when you talk to a lot of entrepreneurs and they're starting businesses, as an entrepreneur, you have to wear an awful lot of hats, right? And there is this kind of belief that you've got to be good at all those different tasks that you have to have in order to do the business. And, do you think it's a mistake a lot of people make and maybe don't bring in external people to along the way to kind of, I might not be very good at accounts, but I'm a very good engineer. I may not be very good at marketing, but I'm a very good engineer. Whatever it is, and bring those people on at an earlier stage.
I think it'd be really important for an entrepreneur to learn very quickly what they're good at,
yeah,
and more so what they're not good at, and very quickly identify people who surround themselves with people who can do those roles. A lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of people I know, try to do everything when they start the business, and they feel that they're responsible for everything. But as soon as they begin to let go, begin to delegate certain responsibilities away, mm-hmm, the quicker their business will be able to blossom, I think, because one woman can't do everything. Mm-hmm. And the more you bring in people around you that can do those key parts, it's vitally important for the health and the growth.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, look, needs must at the beginning. I was Saul, the accountant's department. I was Laura, the HR woman. I had all these emails for all my different personas, depending on who it was. But I think the art of it is, the first part is you have to galvanize people around your idea and get them excited about your mission. And the second part is actually just constantly working on attracting brilliant people who are better than you. And that's all I spend most of my time doing, is first of all trying to attract them. Second part is what obstacles are in your way to help you do a better job. I learned that from Warren Buffett very early on. And I learned two things: how to build a profitable business and how it's all about the people. Mm. So I think, yeah, being humble enough to realize you might have had a good idea, but actually it comes down to the execution of that idea. And most of the time, us with the great ideas aren't the best to create consistent execution, which is what we've just been talking about here. How do you get to 1.4 billion? That is consistent execution. So I think attracting and retaining and developing people is most of my job now.
And therefore, when the role of CEO that you've all had within businesses, what do you think are the most important personal characteristics to make a successful CEO?
Well, I think Andreas mentioned already, hiring people that are better than you and feeling confident in that. I think that you can always learn something from somebody who is less skilled than you, but you learn much more from people who are more skilled than you. And I think you have to have a confidence that you want to learn from those people and go about and do that. I think you have to create a culture where people want to share their views. So, if they have a difference of opinion with you, a disagreement, they can raise that and make their point and you can discuss the outcome of that. But there's not some kind of reluctance on their parts. They want to be open. You want them to fire you a text message and say, you got that wrong, here's a better way to do it, or come into your office, or give you a call and say, here's an improved way of doing that. Because in my experience, the first version of an idea is always wrong. Mm-hmm. It's what you do after that. By the time you get to version 3 or version 4, you can spot the software guy here. You're into a much better situation. And those versions are always formed by people who didn't have the first idea.
Mm-hmm. And setting a North Star, I think, within the business and getting everybody, explaining it really, really clearly to everybody and getting everybody united around where we're going as a business within X 5 years, but even much shorter time frames is a really helpful thing to unite everybody and get everybody around the same, going in the same direction.
So you know, when it comes to the culture, forming the culture of the business, it really is at the CEO's, the book stops at the CEO in terms of defining that and conveying that to the organization.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that, I always think about culture very simply as, what you want, therefore the example you set, but it's also what you tolerate. So I think that the harder things is to deal with poor behaviours, because in my experience, and again, I've only worked in one place, poor behaviours come from people who are probably quite good at probably quite an important role inside the organisation. So if you can't deal with that poor behaviour and that person leaves the organisation, that's a net loss to you from an operational perspective, but it's a net positive on culture. So I think that's often a big focus. I think, though, just to pick up on your point, I think the CEO has a hugely important part in selling the culture, but to me it's a joint enterprise across the organisation. So you need advocates across the entire organisation who are promoting the very best behaviours across. I mean, we're 3,000 people in 22 countries. One person can't carry the responsibility for the culture across all those different locations. It has to be, like I say, a joint enterprise across lots of people.
You're all in different, the businesses that you have are all in different stages, but as a business gets bigger, does the level of innovation or service fall? And how do you stop that? Or, the other thing too is, as you get bigger, you get a risk of distraction. You go into areas that you shouldn't really go into and things like that as you're trying to drive the business. How do you stop that natural thing that things just start to slip? Anyone?
I would say that's very relevant to the stage that we're at. So when you build tech to begin with, you have an idea and you build tech really quickly to launch it and see, does the world actually want what I think they want? And that's the only reason you build it, speed, speed, speed. And then as you go, you realize, well, actually, this isn't scalable. And I've added on all these other parts to it to see, does the market want this other bit that I wanted? And so we've just gone through a period of having to say to ourselves, well, no, we need to go back to go forwards. We need to build a highly scalable, secure platform. And we need to go slow to go fast, is what I tell everyone. We got to go slow to go fast. And you have to readjust. You realize you've got this behemoth of a tech stack now in 7 countries that we're in right now. And so we've been through that pain. And you can potentially slow things down. And then people who've been with you from the very beginning are like, we used to do this in 2 weeks, what's going on? So there's an adjustment. And everything we're doing now, right now, because we're in scale mode, I'm sure you've all been through this, but what we're experiencing right now is moving from being this really fast-paced startup to actually we need consistent building blocks now to execute consistently to have a scalable, secure product. So it's growing up. We're in the, what I tell everyone, we're just growing up now. So you do have that bit of slowing down, but then to pick up the pace again. That's what we've experienced over, I'd say, the last 12 months.
One thing we've added, I suppose, perhaps, the businesses in our group, some of them are a bit older, but added something that a lot of friends of mine who are in business are very cautious, very concerned not to do. They tend not to ultimately bring in elements of share ownership within the staff. Mm-hmm. In terms of your question was, how do you maintain consistent customer care and good product? But I suppose We've brought in different ESOP programs, which doesn't mean giving away the whole business. It means giving away a small part of it, but it buys tremendous unity right across the business and all the different departments of a business that you need to be successful. But everybody, again, is aiming towards the same North Star, but is everybody who's in key positions particularly, or even broader if you want, but everybody's fully bought in. And that sense of ownership is a very, very strong and influential thing within the business to maintain a strong culture.
The interesting thing too, I suppose, when I look at your business area is there is a link to in each of, although they're different businesses, there's actually a kind of a commonality under them in terms of people on the move and trying to get paid when you look at the various different ones. So, you know, they might be discrete companies, but actually underlying it is the same kind of thing.
Yeah. And to be honest, where most of the, it's a couple of different businesses, they're all around fintech, but they're all very related. And how they're all related is ultimately the idea of where they all came from didn't come from me. They came from ultimately something I did was make sure that we ask our customers, how else can we help you? It's such a simple thing, but a lot of people kind of forget to ask, what else can we do for you? And one was way back when I was in college, started this tax back business, helping people get their tax refund. Then we kind of realized when we were sending a tax refund to a guy in Brazil, because it wasn't just for Irish people, we were doing the tax refund, we were doing it for people worldwide. Brazilian guy was getting our check in the post, and the check was taking weeks to get there, and very often it would go missing in the post, and the postman might try to cash it. And ultimately, then when he would ultimately cash it, his bank would charge him ferocious fees to clear the check, and it would take 2 months to clear. We had no idea that this was the experience. And said, Jesus, and customers would say to us, they were blaming us on early days social media that we were taking all their money and bank fees. And it was nothing to do with us. But ultimately, that's where the business transformation came about. Customers asked us, is there a better way to get paid so they don't lose so much fees? And really, by listening, keeping your ears open for your customer, asking them for new ideas, or how else can we help you, is a simple question to ask. Yeah.
Switching to the nuts and bolts, really, in terms of the various different routes, Brendan, Canis is in existence for 38, 39 years, and that, mm-hmm. but it's never, ever raised additional funding, okay, in that period. So what was the motive for the IPO if it was never going to need funding? I'm always interested in this one.
Yeah, I mean, so whatever Canis was formed in 1986, there was that £50,000 of capital raised by Queen's and by Fujitsu. And we made a small loss in the first year, and thereafter we're profitable. Though technically, whenever I took over, we became unprofitable again. That's a whole different story. In terms of the IPO, so I mean, I have to say that I was an IPO denier. So Queen's first mentioned this to us in 2007. And I went, I guess I trotted out all the anecdotes we know. You know, we're not special enough, we're not big enough, we're not profitable enough, for all the reasons you couldn't do it. And that kind of batted that away for 4 or 5 years. And then Queen's once again asked the question. I thought, well, actually, let's go on and have a look at the different aspects of different growth opportunities. So private equity, we were thinking about perhaps a trade sale to dispose of a couple of companies. And we decided on IPO. And probably there were three reasons for that. So the first one was about liquidity, but I'll rephrase that as control. I'll come back to that point in a second. The second one was about equity. So to pick up on Terry's point that, you know, we had, by the time we did the IPO, 68% of the equity was held by employees. They had bought it from Fujitsu and from a VC company over the years. But 85 was great, but there were 700 people in the company. So how could we create an opportunity for people to participate in a friction-free way in the equity in the company and the value they helped create? So we felt IPO would help us get there. And the third thing was, at this stage, you know, we're talking about 2014, we're winning contracts that are kind of 5 million, 8 million, 10 million in size. And our competition has gone from, I guess, smaller companies like ourselves to, you know, IBM and Accenture and Deloitte. And we felt that having the PLC tag at the end of our name will allow us to compete more effectively against those. But skipping back to that first point about liquidity. So yes, it was important that for some of our employee shareholders who were looking to realize some of the value in the company, that they could do so, and IPO would allow them to do that. But the big driver was about control. So in my time as CEO, we started off as a Queen's and Fujitsu. Then Fujitsu sold part of their shareholding to a venture capital company. Fujitsu departed in 2007. The venture capital company departs in 2011. So I've been through two quite big transactions. And on both those, they were incredibly time-absorbing. And the desired outcome by both of the departing parties was to sell the entire company. And that felt like the wrong answer just for them to get that liquidity. So when it came to thinking, having gone through a reasonably professional one, having gone through a very difficult one, and thinking, well, what happens whenever Queens want to realise value in the asset they see in Kainos? And I thought, well, actually, we need to deal with that in advance because most of the shareholders, most of the employees want to see us go on for a long time, maybe longer than Queens might do. So we looked at that as being the best way for us to give us that idea about control. And, you know, looking back, so we're 10 years, almost 10 years on the markets. Of the three kind of aspects, all performed better than we expected. But the third one, the opening up the markets for us was the biggest one. You know, we've won contracts of 90 and 100 million pounds at this stage against those types of organisations. And absolutely having the PLC brand was an important part of that success.
Giving surety to existing customers, but also then opening up a whole set of new customers.
Yeah, I mean, it solved a problem for us we didn't know we had, which is good, but, you know, not knowing you have a problem is not a comforting thing as well. But, you know, we're doing quite a lot of work for UK government. So if I look at last year, 55 million citizens in the UK used one of the services we've built for UK government. But as they were kind of building their reliance on us as being an alternative to the companies I've mentioned, they were concerned that as a private company, the trajectory is quite predictable, that, you know, you get a little bit bigger, you have a really good year, you go to the market, you sell, and who do you sell to? Well, somebody bigger, so you might well finish up being back into one of those companies. So they were beginning to think about their contingency, their alternative plan, rather than doing more business with us, much as we thought we deserved it, and much as they probably thought the same thing as well. They were thinking, well, we have to start looking for other companies so we can defray our concentration risk with Kainos. So we didn't know that was a problem until we did the IPO, and then we happened to meet one of our senior customers, and they said, you know, great job. That's sorted out a problem I had on my desk to sort out. You know, great, you know, but that was an important aspect of building our government business in the UK.
Now, the natural counter to the IPO route is always people say, oh, being listed, I have all this extra regulatory concerns, I have all this compliance, I have to go out and meet shareholders if I'm a US company every quarter, if I'm a UK company or European companies every half year and things like that. When you're not raising capital, you know, are the benefits that you've outlined more than offset? Do they more than offset the you know, the extra headache in terms of you know, all of that regulatory and IR and everything else that goes with it?
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to kind of interacting with shareholders as a public company, you can spend as much time on that as you want. And if I think about, you know, the time I spent with shareholders in a private company, I spent less as a public company CEO. So I mean, to break it down, you know, outside of the IPO process, which is 14 weeks of your life, it's not exactly a huge timeline. The average year, you'll spend 2 1-week periods talking to investors around your results. So that's every 6 months. You'll do 1 week of preparation in advance of that. For reasons I've forgotten, write the annual report as well. So that's another 4 days to do. And you might do 4 or 5 other days of work. So that's it. Now, to me, that's not an awful lot of effort. You know, you're talking about 35, 37 days in the year. And quite a few of the days require no preparation. So you're asked to go in and talk to a new potential shareholder to tell the kind of story. I mean, it's the same set of slides you're telling them. You know, if you can't tell that story, you know, without preparation, then, you know,
you probably shouldn't be in the seat.
You probably shouldn't be in the seat. You know, and so you do maybe 150, 200 of those a year, but, you know, it's turn up, press play, answer the questions, and finish. Now, I'm not being dismissive of it, but it is a very straightforward conversation. I mean, the people you talk to, the fund managers, are interested in the story. They will ask intelligent questions to help them understand more about your business, and they will go off and do a whole pile of research and come back with some more questions. So, you know, it's a relatively painless thing. I mean, the complication can be sometimes if you're doing a day of back-to-back meetings, you know, have you told this joke already? You know, in this session, or was that the session before? Or sometimes at conferences, you're placed in the same room. So bladder control is the most challenging thing of the day because you just go back to back the whole time. But it's a very efficient way of dealing with the shareholders. I think the thing that I didn't mention earlier is that it's a very, I'm going to say a very mature way of doing. So if I'm talking to a shareholder, I tell them something they don't like, you know, they're not going to berate me and give me a hard time. They're going to go, well, didn't like what Brendan said, and they'll sell their shares. There's no drama involved in that. They'll go and sell their shares in Chaos and invest in something they think is a better fit for their investment thesis. So it's all done really quickly. There's no, you know, forced sale of companies or solicitor's letters or any of the stuff I dealt with as a private company CEO.
Andrea, when it comes to taking money from external and scaling up your business, you know, do you feel you're giving up control, or does it give you a better ability to shape the future of the business?
No, Brendan's just sold the whole IPO thing to me. I was a denier until now. My God, that was the best sales pitch ever.
We're having conversions everywhere.
Yeah. That's a myth. You don't give up control of your business. VCs have a job to do. They have their own business to run. They have their own investors to go raise them. Their jobs are hard enough. They have portfolio companies to manage. They're not there to come in and take over the running of your business. They're backing you to do a good job. The thing that I like about external investors is they bring another brain set with them, and they bring discipline. They bring, well, best practice we've seen over here is this. You know, they give you metrics that you wouldn't. They'll give you insights. I love having external investors. I was just saying to Terry, we didn't need to raise any money. We're actually opened around specifically for a VC in the US because they're a brilliant strategic investor. We're now, we've just launched insurance on our platform. It's basically an LP of all the largest insurance companies in the world have brought their top guys together and said, go find portfolio companies. So now we're running pilots with all the top insurance companies. That's the level of value they can bring. Now, the other part is they all want an exit at some point. So it is that question of, well, what is that exit? Are they looking to get you ready for a trade sale? A bit like that. None of my teammates, none of them want Swoop to be sold in the near future. They all want it to grow, and so maybe IPO is the route eventually. But I think external investors have their place. You'll always hear horror stories about VCs, but it's like getting married. You know, you don't take the first VC just because they offer you the money. You have to be confident and know you're getting into a marriage for at least 4 years. And you need to work out how you're divorcing as well. So I
have that question. And choose your partner as well is the basic option here. Yeah.
But it's not. They do not come in and control your business. My thing is, I will say, I've taken UK VC. We have small amount of US VC, and I've got all these US VCs contacting us, and we're going to be profitable by the end of this year, we're in six markets, we're building fintech, we spend 40% of our revenues on tech. And my goal is that I'll never go to a VC and ask for money unless I'm the one in the strong position. And I think if you go in the strong position, you can set better terms for yourself, you can set the tone of how you're running things. So that's been my experience. I have no bad stories to tell you so far on any of our investors.
Terry, now you've done both. You've sold businesses, you've taken on external capital. How do you choose which route for what business?
When we chose investors in some of the business, we were in the fortunate position. I suppose we had a good run rate of revenue, but lots of investors have got tremendous portfolios and have got access to huge customer bases that can be really, really important. And that was a key determinant in some of the decisions we made in terms of choosing the investor. Could they give us access into markets that we weren't already in? Did they have customers, or are they, did they have portfolios that we could, as part of the investment deal, they had to commit to be able to give us direct access and to be able to have a certain run rate of revenue coming from X and Y portfolio customer in order to, for their equity position to be maintained. That was a part of the deal that we made and proved very valuable in terms of the long run, because we got significant customers that we wouldn't, it would have taken us a lot longer to get. So using that, I suppose, having a good business, and we were talking earlier, a profitable business these days is you know, very much in vogue and is really, really necessary. But having a good business isn't necessarily that common. And there's so many private equity investors around the world. They're sitting on hoards and hoards of money. Mm-hmm. They still are, despite the more strange economic times perhaps now. And if you have a good business, you're in a really strong position. Mm-hmm. Using advisors, obviously, like yourselves, to be able to, that's one reason, one of the core reasons to use an advisor, is to be able to identify who they are and to be able to track down, not just one or two that you might meet in a trade show or something like that, but to be able to bring together a whole cohort, but to know, to go to the advisor or to go to the market yourself with not just we're looking for X money, but looking for X money and we want an investor who can give us this portfolio of customers. It's a and knowing an investor, if you go to an investor who understands that you get that, they'll respect you way more, because it's not just dumb money, it's a really intelligent investment is what, and they can see that you have that insight and you can be much more demanding in terms of, again, you've got to give us this customer, you've got to get this customer engaged, in your, we need, and demanding that is something that I'd suggest people should look to do. Because if you have the business, you're in a really strong position. If you've got a good business, I don't want to say it's rare, but there's not oceans and oceans of really successful businesses out there desperate, looking for investors. There's so many investors today. And
what about when it comes to the selling of a business? You know, how do you, you know, particularly more around the timing of that sale? Has it, in your case, was it you doing it or somebody coming and going, here's a big check and we'd like to buy you out?
Last year, we sold a business in the group called Amidas, a global payroll technology. But 2 years before, I was in Boston, Rory, CEO, and I, we were approached by a company who was one of our partners, one of our first partners who used our software. At the end of when we sold Amidas, ultimately, we had five main customers. They were all software partners. They were SuccessFactors, part of SAP, Ceridian and UKG, who ultimately bought the business, and Oracle and one other. But we had one of those two years before offered to buy the business for X, and we decided to hold out. But ultimately, we decided to go and partner with several strategics, all of whom love the software. And at the end of the day, when we did the transaction last year, all of those five partners all put in bids to buy the business. We kind of thought, beforehand, these will be the guys who, one of these five are going to be the buyers of this business. And we kind of cultivated relationships with all of them, and they all put in bids at the end of the day. But we kind of, rather than engaging directly with customer after customer after customer, we used these five different partners to be our sources of customers. We didn't market our product anywhere. We just got leads and leads and leads from all of these software partners. These are much, much bigger organizations who really liked our unique software in global payroll, and they needed to have it. Every one of them put in bids, and it was a really good position to kind of have thought in advance. And that was my colleague Rory Kelleher's idea, and fair play to him. It proved well for all of us.
Brendan, you raised something earlier, and I'm intrigued to get this one, Ashley, on this one, because you said a couple of minutes ago you used to draft the annual report. So I'd love to know the idea, why, number one, you decided to do it, and when you come to that, because obviously a document like that is very public, so it's not just your shareholders that are going to read, it's all of your stakeholders that are going to read that report, and therefore, you know, you can't just literally gloss it in a certain way because certain people are going to read it and tell with others.
Yeah, I mean, our annual report is about 160 pages. So just to be clear, I did the first 40. You know, so all the accounting stuff is done by the team, and I rarely read it because, well, life's too short. In terms of the first 40 pages, I guess I made a decision that, you know, so I would do the slide deck for the investors, and I knew the narrative I wanted to get across there, and that's, I mean, it's a short form 21 slide presentation. I felt the annual report was an opportunity to write a lot more about things that will never feature in the investor presentation, but feed into the overall narrative. So if you look at that kind of 40 pages, there's about 17 of those pages talk about our plan around climate action. It'll talk about how we see ourselves as an employer. So it will mention the fact that, you know, we have issued £127 million worth of shares to staff that have been gifted as part of our gifting program over the last 9 years. That's about that objective of equity. It will talk about the number of graduates who join us. It will talk about the number of people who join us as experienced candidates who've been referred by other people inside the company, which to me is always a strong indication of how the culture of the company is functioning. But those were, I think, pieces of information that were important that people inside the company knew, and this was an opportunity once a year to pull together all this information. Now, I can't imagine many of my colleagues read the report, although it gets downloaded about 4,000 times every 3 months, so somebody is downloading it, if not reading it. But it allowed us to kind of pull together all aspects of the kind of story. And for us, you know, transparency was always really important that we could, you know, anything I would say on an investor call, I would say on a staff call. So, you know, in terms of how we would do our results roadshow, so we publish the results at 7 a.m. on a Monday morning. We do a series of media interviews, then at 9:30, we take all the investment bank analysts through it. And before we meet a single shareholder, the first conference call is to staff saying, well, here's the results. Let me just take you through what this means. And we do a Q&A as well as part of that. So that to me just allowed the annual report a way to bring forward some of that information, because on that first call with staff, you will be using some of the data points from that rather than necessarily from the investor presentation. So anyway, I'm not saying I was right or wrong in that. I'm not doing it next year. I am quite relieved about that, because it took me a bit longer this year to do it than last year. So it's just an opportunity to kind of build that narrative and to use language that was very accessible. So if you read the first 40 pages, I think it's written very simply, so people can pick up, you know, how we make our money and understand that instantly, but also pick up how we think about our other obligations to other stakeholders that are not necessarily shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, given the nature of the Swoop business in terms of how you help clients, what have you learned from helping clients in order to drive your own business?
I tell everyone we're like a case study of our own platform, because I think I learned early on that it's not just one form of finance you're going to have. And I tell loads of startups, it's not pretty at all at the beginning. You're pulling bits from everywhere, like your R&D tax refund, your Leo grant, your whatever. So there's a lot of, I would say, we've lived in every part of it. I think what this, and I'm not just saying it because you're here, but here's an interesting one. I remember one of my most exciting moments in Swoop was we had just built the connection into all the bank accounts for open banking. And we had someone on our platform who was a Barclays customer, and they were rejected for a 25 grand loan. They were only doing 200 grand a year, but they were making payments to their developers in Poland from their Barclays account. Anyway, they got rejected because Barclays said, you can't afford this. And so they came on our platform. It was one of our first integrations. Saturday morning, I'm there looking at the data. And basically, I manually, before we'd built this, worked out how much did Barclays take off him this month? And then I'll work it out. And we had a partnership with TransferMate. So I went on TransferMate and I was going, okay, we could have saved him this. £7,000 I saved him by doing that calculation. Ring him up on the Monday and I'm like, we're going to get you £7,000 back. We got you the £25,000 loan, and that £7,000 is your first year repayments made. You've done nothing but integrate your data with us. And that for me was kind of seeing into other businesses where there was all these opportunities was the bit where, how can I help you? I was seeing it in the data, all these very exciting areas that we could help. So that was one thing, just having that access. But every single entrepreneur you come across has figured something else out, and you learn from every single person you're talking to or that's on your platform. You just get so impressed by the caliber of businesses out there. So I wouldn't say it's one thing. I would say it's you pick a little golden nugget up from everyone that you're exposed to. And the big part being when you see these amounts of data, this is real-time, everyday data of a business, you see the power of what you can do for them. I would say it's a combination of the two.
As CEOs, do you obsess about the small things?
Yes.
Yeah,
I have a phrase. Well, it's not my phrase. It's a very famous Jewish phrase. It's the little foxes that spoil the vines. And it's we all worry about the big fox coming in, but actually it's the little ones that actually come and ruin your age-old vines that are hundreds of years old. And so I would say I'm an auditor first and foremost. That's where my training came from. So I'll be on the bigger stuff, but I'll always zoom back into something and do a walk. I'll do a walkthrough process or an audit of the customer's experience from start to finish. As a mystery shopper myself, and you'll always find something that you could fix.
I was just going to say the same thing. I spend about an hour a day, I'd say, being a pretend customer, ringing up our lines with the different businesses, see what the response is like, see how quick we are to connect from where we need from now to where we want to get to. It's really, really important. I'm not sure that it's a small thing. I think it's a fundamental thing.
Yeah.
It's the customer care. It's why we exist as a business, and mostly if you're a service business, or you know how good we actually are, and be as critical as you can, because you know that way you'll find problems and you'll come up with solutions then to improve it for your ultimate customer. But that's, I'm not sure it's obsessing, but it's a really important part of the job, I think, double checking to make sure you're good enough.
You said straight away yes. There's not even a blink.
Well, I'm a control freak, and you know, to me, it's certainly in our business, there's no single thing makes our business better. There's a whole bunch of small incremental changes. So I think if you don't look for those incremental opportunities, then you don't make those improvements, and therefore your business is less as a result. So it's, you know, again, I don't do this now, but I would get notified anytime somebody resigned from Kainos. I would know that the minute that happened. So I would have a sense about what's going on. I would used to answer comments or posts on Glassdoor, the online jobs community, and say, well, actually, you've said this, and obviously you'd spend more time on the ones that were critical. You would do all those things and say, well, actually, someone's been critical about their time working for us as an employee. What can I do to find out? Is that just a one-off? Is that the person that's left? Or actually, is there something we can learn from that as well? So, you know, I've given you, you know, two examples, but you know, my colleagues would point out lots of different things that you do. And then part of it is then that you get the organization to care. If you're asking, you know, what's our net promoter score for our North American customers this month, you know, people know you're going to ask, so they're going to go and find out. So they're going to do most of that work for you. So you're still caring about the details. You just don't have to do as much work on it as before. And I think that again, it's epic. Small incremental improvements allow you to drive those changes in larger scale.
I have one more question before I'm going to trail out to the floor. So I hope the floor have lots of questions, because I'm sure there's lots of things I haven't covered. Fear of failure, has it been a driving force for you over your careers?
Ever since my 7-year-old neighbour put me out of business, I've been running. No. Yeah, that's you learn a huge amount from failure. Of course you do. You know. It's a driving force. You want to succeed. You want to constantly be out there doing as well as you can. But yeah, the last thing in the world you want to be doing is failing. Mm-hmm. But Irish people are very good to tell you when things aren't going well, and to you know, spotlight your failures very, very quickly. So living in the right country for that. You know.
Well, then in the same vein, I suppose, do you hate losing or prefer winning?
Prefer winning.
Prefer winning.
Prefer winning, absolutely.
There you go. Right. On that one, I'm going to throw it out to the audience for questions. So please, if you do have a question, just stick your hand up. We have some mics floating around. There must be somebody with questions. Please tell me there's somebody with questions. Unfortunately, my high-tech gizmo has broken down, so there could well have been questions along the way. Yep.
Hi, Alan Tyrrell from Teneo. Just really fascinating to hear all the stories. A kind of a non-financial, non-monetary question, which might seem a bit weird, but getting the balance right between the profit motive and the profit and the shareholder value creation and creating a social dividend for society. Any thoughts on that and the role of business in that regard?
I think every company has to make its own decision on that. We talk a lot internally and to one of the earlier points, a bit small details. So when I was in my previous role, every Monday morning I would meet all the people who were joining Chaos that week, and I would spend an hour with them and talk about, I guess, our expectations of them, but really just share some stories around the company. And in that, we were very clear about our three priorities. They're all important to us, but they were ranked in order. So number one was about the people in the organization. So we wanted the best people to join and stay at Chaos. And in order for us to do that, we needed to be a great employer. So it was our number one priority. We would be a great employer for the talented people who joined the company. And number two was about customer success. So we deal with 1,000 customers across our organization. Every year, 90% of our revenue comes from existing clients. So keeping them comfortable with the service we provide them, the quality of what we do for them is key as well. And the third one was about us being a growing, profitable and responsible company, which covered quite a lot, but we're growth oriented. We hire talented people because they want to develop their careers. That means that we have to look to grow the organization. That in itself often grows shareholder value. The profit element, going back to my point about control, I like the fact the company's in control of its future. The fact that we're strongly profitable, so we have a 20% net profit performance, allows us to make choices about what products we invest in, what companies or which countries we open. And it allows us to have freedom of decision around acquisitions. So that's part of the plan as well. So profit allows us to do that. So we don't exist to be profitable, but profit allows us to exist. And we have to really reinforce that across the organization. And then, for us, we have an opportunity to reduce our carbon footprint. We are, a low carbon organization anyway, because we're very much professional services, but we've taken a choice to do that. And this year we missed meeting our net zero target by eight tons. So next year we have to go again and get below that bar. But we have significant things we do for young people. So this year, just over 2,000 young people have spent at least a week working with some of my Kainos colleagues to find out, do they want to do a career in digital technology? And that's across our offices in Ireland, in the UK, in Poland, and in the US and Canada. Now, you can choose to do those, you can choose not to do them, you can choose to do different things, but they're not always competing with one another for funding, because the reality is that if you do a good job of keeping people in the organization, some of whom will stay because of, our carbon stance or our outreach activities, then you are making your company more profitable. Because for us, inefficiency, so staff turnover, drives profits down, so keeping people engaged. So there's not, to me, always a competing between those different elements of creation of value for employees, from shareholders, for other stakeholders.
Another question.
Much to add there, Alan, just perhaps may depend really on the stage of your business. I suppose if you're in the startup phase, it's probably an awful lot less in a position to be able to give back than if you're more mature and developed business. But we've found in the last, I suppose, has been involved with on the giving back side, ultimately it very much comes back, and we kind of feel like we're involved with some initiatives where our staff then ultimately get the benefit of some of those initiatives on the reverse. And so what goes around, I think, very often comes around. So.
Yeah, for us, obviously we're younger, but we don't see it as competing at all. In fact, we see one feeds the other. So we run a lot of education programs. So around our mission is access to finance for a business owner, no matter who they are or where they're located in the world. And that's what tech should be doing, is delivering that. So we run programs in Atlanta for black female founders, the most underrepresented group in society. So how do we lift them up? We do inner city step up programs in the UK. How do we lift them up? But actually what we're doing is creating future customers for ourselves. So at the moment, we're investing in that to help them become financially literate, to help them understand the funding landscape. We're lifting them up. They will lift our business up. It does something for your staff. Like we attracted tech developers into Swoop from all over because they loved the mission. Like, we just funded a business in South Africa to invest in trucks and hire 10 people. The entire team is so on a mission now to continue to build our product. So sometimes I think it's not us being charitable or creating social dividend. It's just, I always say, if you're unlocking an underrepresented group, it's just good business, and you can do good while you're aiming for profit as well. So I think finding something that's relevant to your business that can then have that virtuous cycle is a good way to go about it.
Hi, thanks very much, folks. Extremely enjoyable. My name is Michael Culligan. I'm from a company, No Friction. We're a fintech and a financial institution. I spent many years previously with young startup companies, and I guess I'm really, really interested and obviously aligned with getting the best people on board is so, so central to success. And you've spoken a little bit about culture. So I'm just interested in any observations you have and what you've done to get the best people on board. And I suppose trying to make sure you'll have people who will be culturally aligned and I guess hang around. Any observations on that?
Step in.
I'm fairly simple about culture, if I'm really honest. I think maybe it's because of the size. There's 130 of us in different locations around the world. And I follow sport a lot I love, like, there was a great book on the All Blacks, and since then the Mercedes Formula One team has adopted a lot of that, and it was like, don't hire kids, you know, don't hire people who fundamentally don't have the grit, the determination, the humility, the energy. And we've had, I mean, a little bit like you were saying, you've people who are phenomenal at their job, could be your best salesperson, but they're ruining the environment for everyone else. And we've had that situation. And when you're a young business and growth is everything and momentum, et cetera, that's a tough decision to make. But I kept coming back to everyone, remember, we read the piece on Mercedes Formula One, Toto Wolff said this. And when you put it into analogies like that, it just gives you the confidence to just make the decision and do it. What actually ended up happening, because this was a huge sales star in our business, what ended up happening was, as soon as he was gone out the door, the ones who were subordinate ended up absolutely flourishing and made up that lost revenue literally within the month. And you get unknown superstars coming through. So it's hard to walk the walk, especially when you're our age and you've got VCs and everyone coming looking at you. But our experience so far has been that actually is true. It genuinely has been the case. So I think minding that, I just call it, is there, I remember the day when I decided to leave my big four firm. I physically couldn't walk up the steps. I was so miserable. I'd had a great time, but I'd just gotten to that point. So my thing, all I do is ask people, are you happy? Do you enjoy your job? Like, do you see it as a job? Or do you wake up every day and you're like, yeah, I just need to get into this? And that's pretty much our survey. And you can always find where there's politics going on. I think when you're our size, probably much harder at your stage. But if you show people you're willing to let go of your top salesperson because of what they're doing, I think that kind of sets the scene.
And perhaps from a speed point of view, to address it as soon as possible. Yeah. And to bring it up with the person and ask them, will they change their behavior, but don't let something fester. Very often it's so much easier to let a person who may be, let's say, not a cultural fit, just faster, and hope that they might improve over time. Correct, ask them to correct it, the behavior, or to highlight what the issue is. And it, if it doesn't, if the longer you let it drag on, the longer it seeps into the wider business. Yeah, and so deal with it as soon as you can.
Yeah, that was my regret. We didn't do it soon enough.
Thanks very much, folks. Thank you.
Have we any other questions? Yeah, a few floating around.
Thanks, Aidan, and thanks to the panel. D-Line's founder and CEO of Examfly. We're an early scaling company ourselves here with my colleague Ali Hill. So we'd just love to get your perspective on how you deal with the inevitable kind of setbacks and very hard days that come as the CEO of a growing company. Any psychological tips you could pass on would be helpful.
There's a great book called The Hard Thing About Hard Things. I don't know whether you've read it, but that to me, I tell everyone I meet. And there's a brilliant chapter in there, and it's basically about entrepreneurs only have two emotions. It's either complete elation or you're in the depths of despair, and it's usually at 3 a.m. in the morning. And I think that kind of sums up our lives, doesn't it? And usually it's because it's coming to the end of the month and payroll's coming up and you've got hungry mouths to feed. And a big, might be a VC, has told you that they're putting the money in on the Friday and suddenly they've walked away and all of these things. And I've been through every iteration of these, by the way. And I think the only thing is when your back's up against wall, you know, something happens to you. I think you just outperform yourself and you find a way through. And the more and more you have those, or this is what's happened to me, you realize it's not the end of the world, right? You've survived about 100 of these before. So suddenly you can cope a bit more. And then the good ones, like we've just launched with Compare the Market in the UK, right? Massive company. And everyone was jumping up and I was like, yeah, no, I'm not jumping up for joy anymore. It's not that I'm not celebrating the wins anymore. I'm just so cynical about everything. It's all very well, it's launched, but there's a whole heap of problems coming down the track that we haven't thought of right now. I think just the more you have the highs and the lows, it all starts to balance itself out. And I loved the lows. When I look back on them, I realize we're a better company and I'm a better CEO and founder having survived them. So, I think if it's 3 a.m., no, there's about... Oh, and I can tell you this from our data. Here's a sad fact for you. The highest registrations we have is between 12 a.m. and 7 a.m. in the morning. And I have a thing that goes off on my phone on Slack every time someone registers on our platform, Christmas Day, busiest day. It's really quite sad. It's Sundays, Christmas Day, and the middle of the night. Yes, yeah, so you're not alone. That's what I'd say, yeah.
One more question, yeah.
Sorry, my name is Maurice Roach. I am from a venture capital company called Delta Partners. We have invested in about 160 companies, and we probably have sold, disposed, liquidated about 120 of them. And the question I ask most of them at the end is, you know, when I see some of our companies on a panel like this, it's always a linear path to success. It never has been a linear path to success, and even in our most successful investments. So at what point in time was your worst moment in terms of building a company? I can tell you some of the worst moments I've had in certain companies when they're running out of payroll on a Friday and they call you on a Thursday to say, how do we solve this? And how, because I think you all three have perseverance, and I think the most successful entrepreneurs have perseverance to get over the bad times. So what was the worst moment in your building the business, and how did you get over it?
Let's start with you, Brendan.
The worst... I'll give you the top three, but so I mentioned that I took over from the founding CEO in June or July of 2001, and at that stage our parent company Fujitsu accounted for 93% of our revenues. And then the following April I got a phone call from the head of commercial in Fujitsu, who was saying that they were stopping a single contract that accounted for 48% of our revenues. So that was a Friday at 4 o'clock. So that was the, they were saying, thankfully it was a Friday because it gave me time to kind of process that. So to the earlier question about psychological tools, I mean, to me, you have to give yourself a time to panic because, you know, that's the natural reaction to that. And then you need to start working out how to fix the issues. That was the most difficult time. That what it meant for us as a business, that out of 240 people, I had to ask 38 colleagues who were perfectly talented to leave the business. You go through all the usual kind of, you know, reduction in expenditure, because for us it was about fighting to stay alive. And that fight took 4 years. So we made a fantastic loss of £1.8 million in that year, followed with another loss of £1.2 million the following year, made 15K profit the year after that, and made the tidy sum of 45K the year after that. So that was a huge turnaround effort. But to the point that Andrea's made, that your culture is forged under times of strain and stress, not during times of success. It's easy to be a happy company when things are going well. It's whenever things are going badly that you see who can really help turn the business around. But that's probably the top example for me.
Terry, Andrea?
I've been involved in businesses since a long time, but given that, and every year there's a problem. And when you're talking about raising, I've been awake at 3 o'clock in the morning. If anybody here is in business, I'm fairly sure you're all awake at 3 o'clock. Because business is constantly, it's never a straight, it's never simple. No matter how new or mature your business or just starting, it's never easy. If it was easy, you know, everybody in the world would be doing it. So not that many people out of 100 people are starting a business and developing and getting it going. It's a very small number of people who are really the dynamo, the entrepreneurs. And it's very, very common to be awake at 3 o'clock in the morning because there's always a problem. And I'm very, you know, but even more recently, we had a business in our group, TBI, is involved in recovering VAT for companies who travel abroad. And it was going really, really well. It was good revenue and it's good profitability. And then COVID hit and nobody traveled anymore. And didn't travel, not just for a week. We thought listening to the radio, people wouldn't be traveling maybe for a week, and then dragged out to be 2 weeks. And then there was new things. And then it was a month. And what are we doing with our team? We had about 200-300 people in the company. And it was extraordinarily stressful for us and our leadership team. And as Brendan says, it very much boils back to how strong the culture is within the business. We were able to ultimately, stemming from it, we have a phoenix that's rise. We still do that business now, 3 years later, 4 years later, but we've developed a brand new technology which we can sell to the exact same customers but didn't require travel. And ultimately now we have two businesses that have emerged, but very much because we had the unity and the people to be able to. We had to cut back on certain costs, we had to cut back on certain things, but it's a much stronger business now as a result, because people didn't fight with each other, and said they worked together to get to fight through it. And having that unity or that culture, it's a really key to deal with any challenge, I think.
COVID for us was one of the big ones, because our main market at the time was the UK, and Rishi Sunak came out and said, oh, there's bounce back loans for every business. You fill out three things and you get £50,000 into your account and 2%. If you're over a 10-year loan repayment, and effectively became the biggest competitor in the market to every lender in the market, and there was no fees to be earned from distributing these. So we had this issue of no one could get through to their banks. So we had a 7,000% increase in customer acquisition, and we had a situation of matching all these businesses to funding but not getting paid anything, and we're a young tech company and we're trying to survive. And but what we did is we spun up a COVID platform and went to those who were getting a bad rep, the insurers that were getting a bad rep for not paying out in business interruption, and said, you should sponsor this so you can point to good stuff that you did. And we got funded by a sponsorship from some of the main banks and insurance companies. And that helped us to survive. And we actually grew our customer base because we were there for them when no one else was. But that 2 years was like, oh my God. God, how are we surviving this? I'll never forget the quarter when normal life resumed, and our revenues just shot through the roof. And it was like, I never thought that moment would come, because you're living through 2 years of survival. You don't want to let, we didn't let anyone go. We'd no furlough, we'd no anything. But it was a really, really tough 2 years, I would say. We'd COVID, we had hard Brexit, we had Liz Truss coming out with the most ridiculous budget. We've had, honest to God, I was like, I really feel like when I go in front of a VC, I can go, throw anything at me. We've had high interest rate environment, we've had everything, and we're still here. So I always say at our annual event, I always go, we're still here. That's the most important thing, we're still here.
Still in the fight.
And the thing I would say on culture, the two things I do at the annual stand-up is, we're still here, so we've survived, congratulate ourselves. The second one I do is I tell them, whatever was my biggest mistake of the year and how much I've cost the company because of that mistake. And they're all like, I remember the first year I did it, and they were like, what is she doing? Like, she's saying she cost us $500,000 in our early startup years. But actually what comes to that is people then go, oh, this happened, or they'll own up to stuff. But you feel really battle hardened after your big low of something like COVID, I have to say. Yeah.
Well, look, I'm conscious of time, so I think we're going to wrap things up there. I want to thank my panelists, Terry, Andrea, and Brendan. I want to thank you, our audience, and our guests for coming along. Let me be very clear. I have the easiest job in all of this, these types of things. I don't have to do all of the organization that goes on behind everything. There is a big team that does all of that. But particularly the events team of Ruth, Emma, Sue, Keely, Emmett, they're very, very important. But also then my colleagues in private clients, the guys in David Corporate Finance, particularly Derek, Jonathan, and Barry. We've some of our friends from Euronext are here, Adam and Niall as well. And also, obviously, given we're in this beautiful room, I want to thank Bank of Ireland and College Green, particularly John McGrath for all of his assistance in setting this up. I want to thank the HBV guys for doing the audio and the video. While this is the end of this session, the official proceedings, we are going across the street over to the Bankers Pub. If anybody wants to join us, we'll have some drinks and some mingling over there. I'm going to have one last shameless plug of the Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly podcast. I expect to see a significant jump up in the number of subscribers after this event, and if not, remember, I know all of your names and your email addresses. I will chase you down. But listen, thank you very much for coming. We hope you found it very, very good, and as I said, we hopefully will have another one of these early in the new year, so do please stay in tune. But again, most importantly, I'd like to thank my guests for coming along. Thank you very much.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK, and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.